When Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified before Congress, one of the more noteworthy moments was when he told Senator Kamala Harris that her line of questioning was making him nervous. Senator Harris was also interrupted by male senators during this line of questioning and had previously been interrupted when she questioned Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. It led some people to question if Sessions' remark, as well as the interruptions, were based on the fact that Senator Harris is a woman of color and not on her line of questioning. Increasingly, research is confirming that we all make snap judgments based on appearances and first impressions, and this can have serious consequences in the world of politics, policing, and job interviews. Alexander Todorov, a professor of psychology at Princeton University, has written Face Value: The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. It's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm very pleased that he joins us now on our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Aren't you in high demand from political campaigns?
As a general rule, I do not participate in this kind of campaign, so I try to stay away from being involved.
But you must have thought about the judgments that voters made about the appearances of the various candidates: Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, also Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I have to say that most of our findings really apply to voters who are really uninformed and know next to nothing about politics. And more importantly, once you have knowledge about the politicians, this changes completely the rules of the game.
Well, there's been reports that sexism did indeed play a role in the 2016 election. Do first impressions play a role in sexism?
Absolutely. I mean, we make these impressions, as you mentioned, extremely rapidly. You can present a participant in an experiment with a face for less than 1/10 of a second, and that provides enough time for people to make up their mind one way or another. And certainly, the moment you classify a face as belonging to ethnicity or gender, all kinds of stereotypes are activated. There's an interesting finding from the 80s, where most symphony orchestras were mainly populated by men, so there were very few women. And suddenly there was an influx of women in large orchestra, and what caused the change was the introduction of blind auditions. That is, the performers will perform behind the curtain, so the committee couldn't see them. And that was the big difference.
Otherwise, they would have thought that just because she was a woman, she didn't play the violin as well as the male candidate?
Quite likely. I think that most people are not explicitly sexist or racist, and most people want to do the right thing. But psychological biases are very subtle, and they can color and nudge our judgments one way or another. Most of the time, what you observe in the world is fairly ambiguous. It's not very clear cut what the performance is, and these prior biases can color your evaluation.
A politician has called Kamala Harris's questioning hysterical, and he seemed to be oblivious to the fact that hysterical applies to women.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to get rid of these stereotypes, and often it's worse when we are completely unaware that we fall to using these stereotypes.
Politicians seem to know about the importance of appearance during campaigns. Abraham Lincoln was the first candidate to use pictures in an electoral campaign, even though it was thought that he was not the handsomest of men. How did he take into account his appearance?
That's right. In fact, there is also evidence that he changed his appearance, presumably prompted by a memo by his Republican fellows who asked him to grow whiskers and a beard, and so he actually changed his appearance.
So he grew it for the campaign?
Presumably.
Hillary Clinton smiled a lot more than Donald Trump. Would that have been a positive thing for her?
Generally, smiling is always a very positive thing. Emotional expressions are one of the main inputs to our first impressions. And in that sense, first impressions might be relatively good guides to what the person is feeling here and now at the moment, but they're probably a very poor guide to the person's character in general.
Much has been made of Donald Trump's hair. If he were bald or balding, would that change people's impressions of him?
I mean, this particular candidates, or we know so much about them that already people, once you have a very strong opinion, once you have a knowledge about a person, that also changes how see their image.
But hair really does seem to have an impact on how we judge people. Rudy Giuliani abandoned his comb-over to reveal that he was bald after he dropped out of politics. Joe Biden had hair plug surgery many years ago. It was a big thing at the time. Now we don't even think about it.
Yeah, well, part of this is that we all would like to look at our best, and hair is an issue for many men, including myself. But
it's too late for me.
Perhaps, you never know. But there's actually an illusion that you illustrate in the book. You can have an ambiguous face that could look either like a Hispanic or an African-American, and depending on the hairstyle, you can change the perception of the face. So certainly hair makes a big difference. I remember watching I'm Not There. This is a movie about Bob Dylan with different actors impersonating him, and in the beginning it starts with snapshots of the actors, and at some point I looked at the snapshot and I thought, wow, I didn't realize he was so handsome. And then my wife politely pointed out, no, this is Cate Blanchett.
And sometimes we can't tell right away whether the face we're seeing, if it flashes by us, is a male or female face?
We probably access this information very quickly. It is possible to create a morphing image where you can I can shift your perceptions, but generally gender, race, and age are information that we can extract very rapidly from faces. But if you can morph, you can create an average of a few dozens of male and female faces, and there's very subtle ways which you can make the face to look a man or a woman, and this is also illustrated in the book. Basically, if you increase the contrast between the eyebrows and the mouth relative to the face looks like a woman. And that incidentally explains why makeup is so popular. It just increases the femininity and hence the attractiveness of a face.
My guest is Alexander Todorov, a professor of psychology at Princeton University. His book, Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions, it is published by Princeton University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It's unlikely that people would ever admit to judging political candidates by their appearances. The traits that many people say that they care about is confidence and trustworthiness. Can people judge those traits based on someone's face or body language?
Well, they can make the judgment. That doesn't mean that the judgment is accurate. So, for example, you're right in the politician's case is judgment of competence or apparent competence are highly predictive of electoral success. But again, if this was about real competence, you would expect these sorts of judgments to predict across all kinds of voters. But in fact, the more voters know about the politicians, the less appearance has any effect whatsoever.
Are there certain traits that make someone look confident or trustworthy?
We are able actually to build mathematical models of different impressions which capture and visualize these stereotypes, so we can, in a sense, decompose the stereotypes into different ingredients.
You were talking about those headshots in the book that have been digitally manipulated to look more dominant or aggressive or the opposite?
Precisely. And we can exaggerate, or we can decrease or increase the apparent trustworthiness, dominance, aggressiveness, criminal appearance, any kinds of visual judgment where people agree. And in the case of trustworthiness, for example, you can see that one of the main inputs is emotional expression. So faces that resemble smiling faces are perceived more positively. Faces that resemble angry faces. Femininity, masculinity is very important input too.
But does it vary depending on one's political inclinations?
In fact, it does. I have a chapter in which I discuss these findings. It turns out that depending on your political orientation, you might prefer different kinds of leaders in terms of appearance. So right-wing inclined voters prefer faces of dominant, masculine-looking leaders, whereas left-wing voters prefer faces of more feminine-looking leaders.
Although in the case of Bernie Sanders, he's not feminine looking. I mean, but he's kindly looking.
Yes. It is very hard to make a judgment for a specific person. I mean, again, as a general rule, I don't discuss specific politicians, but also when we do this studies, we would look, let's say, at 100 different Senate races or 100 gubernatorial races. We never would try to place our bets on this kind of snapshot judgments to predict a specific election.
Well, after the fact, can't you learn a lot more than before?
Well, with hindsight bias, it always feels that we knew much more and we learned much more, but who knows?
How much do first impressions stick? Can't someone do something that would make us change our initial perception?
In fact, we change our minds very, very easily about others. The question is whether you will have the opportunity to observe them in a situation where you get a real sense of their character.
Don't these studies have their roots in kind of non-science, physiognomy and eugenics?
Absolutely, and a lot of my book, and it starts with the history of physiognomy and how it has been linked to eugenics. And physiognomy, the pseudoscience of reading character from facial appearance, has a very long history, with the first preserved document dating back to Aristotle's time. And then it got really, really popular in the 18th, 19th, early 20th century. Francis Galton, who is the father of eugenics, in fact, he invented the composite photography, which is, you can think of all modern morphing methods as deriving from the composite photography of Galton, where you can superimpose different plates of photographs and create an average image. And he was really excited about this technique because for him, this was the ideal tool of eugenics. Because if you can discover the ideal British type, well, half of your work is done. You should encourage only those who look like the ideal British type to breed and discourage the ones who don't.
What were some of the early studies on physiognomy and phrenology?
They're tightly connected. They're certainly connected, phrenology and physiognomy. In fact, Lavater, who I guess we owe the huge popularity of physiognomy to his writings at the end of 18th century, had an instrument which was for cranial measurement, which preceded
the bumps on a head were considered important.
In fact, that was a big part of phrenology.
And what would they reveal?
Well, now we know that they reveal nothing.
So this is all just junk science, but it masqueraded as real science.
Yes, it did. And I mean, this is 18th and 19th century. Even physiognomy, it's interesting, after Galton created the composite photography, there was an editorial in Science from 1886. And the editorial was very positive, and the premise was that perhaps now physiognomy will be a real science with this invention of Galton.
Haven't scientists also used evolutionary theories to justify stereotypes based on facial traits?
Quite a bit. And again, I have a chapter called Evolutionary Stories, which discusses the history and some current modern hypotheses which are predicting that perhaps your character might be expressed to some extent in the face. And my view is that there is not much into this. But certainly in early 20th century, the physiognomists didn't call themselves physiognomists, they called themselves character analysts, and they were actually involved in a lot of businesses. And a lot of their framing or the way they would justify their beliefs was in terms of evolutionary theory.
Can you talk about the work of Catherine Blackford and Arthur Newcomb?
So they were super popular. They wrote several books, and they were involved in... they actually had some great ideas. They wanted to create this so-called, what would be the equivalent of human resources now. And their main objective was to find out what is the best way to find the right employees. The problem is that they thought that the best way to find the right employees is just do character analysis based on facial appearance, and had a whole technique that if the person comes for an interview, the interview is all bogus because it's not important what you say, but what's important is that the interviewer who is trained in character analysis will make certain notes on your appearance, and that will reveal what you are and whether you will be really fit for the job.
They also had theories about people who lived in cold climates and people who lived in warm weather.
Exactly. I mean, the problem is, in fact, some of the reasoning was actually kind of right, but at the same time, it was infused with so much prejudice.
Alexander Todorov is professor of psychology at Princeton University, where he's also affiliated with the Princeton Neuroscience Institute and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His book, Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions, is published by Princeton University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Alexander Todorov, T-O-D-O-R-O-V. His book, Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions, published by Princeton University Press. How long does it take for people to form an impression based on a face? If you flash one by them, do they make instant impressions?
People do. There's many, many controlled experiments where you can manipulate how long you present the face. And in fact, if the face is presented for less than 30 milliseconds, there's already enough in their judgment that would correspond to their judgment if they had unlimited time. And essentially, you don't need a presentation more than 160 milliseconds. That doesn't mean that this is the time within which you make the judgment. It takes about 100 milliseconds for visual information to get from the retina to the brain areas, which are specifically dedicated to processing of faces, but it is a very, very rapid judgment, which is made from minimal information.
And then, as you said, with job interviews, the feeling was that that impression was more important than anything the interviewee said?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of work. We have known this for about 40 years in psychology, that job interviews, unstructured job interviews, that is, are fairly useless in terms of predicting professional success. They're very, very weakly correlated with the outcomes, but we put too much faith into them.
Hasn't it also been applied to sports teams?
Yeah, I mean, the great example of this is the success of Billy Bean and the Oakland A's, which is described in Michael Lewis' book Moneyball. And the story is that he is a team in Major League Baseball, which is not as wealthy. It's not as wealthy as the other teams, like the Yankees or the Red Sox, and yet they've been consistently successful. And the secret of his success is essentially exploiting the prejudices of appearance, because he would find those college players, and only college players, because there's enough statistical information for them. He would never go after high school players who have incredibly good statistics but don't look the part. And some of them never even dreamed to be part in Major League Baseball. And that was the secret of success.
Because scouts would judge them based on certain stereotypes and not necessarily pick the right one. They'll pick the one that they thought looked like he or she would be the best player.
That's right. And in fact, some scouts, they still have an expression, the good face. And the idea is that you can tell from the face of a player whether they could make it big in the Major League Baseball.
Isn't there a facial width to height ratio that they rely on?
Well, this has been a measure that I think is deeply, deeply flawed and has been extensively used in the last maybe 10 or 15 years. And I discuss all of the major flaws of this measure and how whatever it's predicting has been quite exaggerated in the literature. And incidentally, this was a measure that was used quite a bit in the early 20th century, is trying to stop lots of immigrants coming to the United States, because presumably this was a measure of their intelligence.
Well, how does it apply and what are the flaws?
Well, first of all, it's not a very reliable measure, so you will get different measures depending on what camera is used, what is the angle. But most importantly, the reason when this measure was introduced, the basic premise is that it indicates a sexual dimorphism. That is, it is bigger for men rather than for women. But there's so much variance, and there have been now dozens and dozens of studies over thousands of subjects. And if you look at the relationship between this measure and gender, and this is kind of a key for this evolutionary hypothesis, in fact, this is a good measure, it's the correlation is just minuscule. I mean, it's like barely above zero. And if you compare this with things like body weight, height, upper body mass, these correlations are huge. And these things are easily accessible and available in real world setting.
We make decisions in all sorts of different ways. Haven't banks and financial institutions been guilty of making judgments based on people's faces? And then the people going to the bank and looking at the financial advisor making all their own judgments?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent nowadays you have much less of these face-to-face interactions, but to the extent that you have face interaction, there would be always present a bias. Even now, you go to a car dealership, and the first thing they're looking at, well, what car you're driving, and the dealers might be completely inaccurate, but they immediately decide whether you're a valuable customer. And if you're driving a Mazda and you're going to Audi dealership, they might look down upon you.
There are psychological studies about how people invest their money. And is it based on what we're talking about here?
There are lots of experiments where you can do this is experimental games that are often used in economics and in psychology. And there are dozens and dozens of these studies showing that, in fact, if you have these sorts of interactions that are one-shot interactions and there's no reputation information involved, we are heavily influenced by the appearance of the others.
Can facial qualities affect whether someone might be falsely accused or convicted of a crime?
Certainly. There are many, many studies, but experimental studies. There are a few field studies that are much harder to conduct, but there was a recent study which looked at the prisoners in Florida, and Florida is one of the few states in the United States which publishes the images of all of its prison population, and it turned out that prisoners convicted for the same crime, but some were sentenced to death and some were sentenced to parole, a life sentence without parole. The difference was one of the differences, at least, that the prisoners who got the death sentence looked more untrustworthy. And this is after controlling for race and many other...
Although race is definitely a factor, and many
race
people
is
feel
absolutely
that
a huge people, factor.
People consider race a factor on trustworthiness and the like. Dark means dangerous in some cultures.
Race is extremely important, and as I mentioned earlier, the moment you categorize a face as belonging to ethnicities, this comes with all kinds of stereotypes and prejudices, and you're right, there is very well documented biases based on the skin color of the race. So even within African Americans, people with darker skin, they're more likely to be discriminated against.
I would assume this also affects someone getting out on parole. Can facial hair or tattoos influence whether we might consider someone untrustworthy?
I had a graduate student who actually did some kind of work, and in fact, facial tattoos increase perceptions of untrustworthiness.
And tattoos themselves are because they might represent something that is out of the ordinary.
It could be. There's not that much work. It's interesting that Cesare Lombroso was the founder of criminal anthropology in 19th century, and he worked in 19th century, early 20th century, and had all of these elaborated theories that criminals were subhumans, and he wrote all of these books, The Criminal Man, The Criminal Woman, and one of the major characteristics for him were tattoos, but he would have had a really hard time today.
Children judge faces in the same ways that adults do?
Unfortunately, they do. So these stereotypes are acquired very early in life. We have done studies with colleagues from Harvard, and you look at 3 years old, and their judgments when they have to decide whether a face is nice or not look very much like the judgments of adults.
Mostly smiles or something else?
Mostly smiles, and then femininity, masculinity. So we tend to like and trust feminine faces more than masculine faces.
Many people assume that the most obvious trait in a person when you look at a face is their sex, but aren't there small effects that can change whether you see someone as male or female? You mentioned makeup, eyebrows. What else?
Makeup, eyebrows, hair. I mean, lots of things can change the impressions. But again, if it's in some cases, that would be difficult, obviously. But faces that are more into the middle of the continuum between extreme masculinity, extreme femininity, it might be relatively easy by using makeup or other means to change the perception of gender.
And would people find a female face more trustworthy than a male face?
On average, yes.
What about competence?
Competence, it's a very interesting story. As I mentioned, we build these models that visualize competence, and if you look at what would appear competent and incompetent face, it doesn't seem to differ in masculinity, femininity. But we can actually remove the attractiveness from competence, and this, it's in real life, these are highly correlated. So on average, competent-looking faces will be perceived as more attractive. But because we have formal models, we can simply subtract the attractiveness. And what you are left with after remove the attractiveness is masculinity and confidence. So you can say, well, this is what is the stereotype of competence, masculine, confident, attractive look.
So a person who is more attractive by the societal demand, societal norms, is more likely to be hired or be trusted? I mean, how far do we go? Is Cary Grant considered somebody who we would have trusted more than Lee Marvin?
all else being equal, without any prior information, perhaps.
So it's good to be born good-looking if you want to be a criminal.
Oh, yeah. and not only, even if you choose a normal career in life, it's always good for you.
Haven't there also been studies done on whether or not people can guess sexual orientation based on a face? How are those studies conducted?
There have been many studies on sexual orientation, and presumably they show that we are better than chance. I have two things to say about this kind of studies. First, most of these studies have sampled their images from online dating websites. That introduces a huge experimental confound, because these images are not sampled randomly, but they're deliberately selected by the users. There was a recent study which controlled for the quality of the images, and once you control for this, there were no differences found. And the second thing is that if you look at the rates, so in any kinds of uncertain decision, you have two things. You have your hit rate, how many gay people you identify, and you have a false positive rate, how many straight people you misidentify as gay. And if you take the false positive rates of the studies, and if you consider that we have very few, relatively, generally have about 4% of gay people who identify as gay, you end up with a huge number of false positives. So if you apply these rates to a random sample of 1,000 people, you will misidentify over 300 straight people as gay. So this kind of accuracy is not going to get you too far in the real world.
What about other dating sites? Should people be aware of the kinds of pictures that they post?
People should be aware of the kind of pictures they post for any kind of website, whether it's LinkedIn, and presumably your picture on LinkedIn would be different than a picture on an online dating website, or a picture that is really about only your friends to see on Facebook. So, and they should be aware, because we make too much out of too little information.
There are many blurred images in your book. Why do scientists use blurred images when they're studying facial recognition?
Well, it's interesting because in this particular chapter, the point is that we typically say that we're incredibly good at recognizing faces, and this is partially true. I mean, until a few years ago, there was no machine algorithm that was better than humans in recognizing faces. This has changed in the last few years. For better or worse. But this is partially true because we are very, very good at recognizing familiar faces. So you can take a familiar face that you're high, take Trump or you take Hillary Clinton, and you can actually make it very grainy. You can squash it, you can stretch it, and you can still recognize it. This is quite amazing in terms of vision.
This is why we recognize political cartoons as being about a certain character, even though they distort quite a bit.
Yes, and in fact, there are lots of interesting psychological studies what makes cartoons more recognizable. You increase a prototypical features that are diagnostic about the person. But we are actually quite poor at recognizing unfamiliar face, and that might seem like a strange thing, but you can think of even looking at two images and deciding whether these two images represent the same person or not.
Are there certain people who are better at doing this than others?
Well, it's fascinating. If you look at face recognition in particular, there is about 2.5% of the population who have serious problems recognizing faces, and we they're usually described as having developmental prosopagnosial developmental face blindness, but they've been also super face recognizers, who are fascinating, and they're really good at recognizing faces.
Alexander Todorov's book, Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions, is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you for having me.